You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber, and tonight on Right on Radio, Ian Graham Leese talks with Martin Keller, the author of The Space Pen Club, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, UFO Disclosures, Consciousness, and Other Mind Zoomers. Keller's a former pop culture journalist, published author, and unproduced screenplay writer. His work has appeared in Rolling Stone, The Washington Post, The Boston Globe, and many others. Keller also has written Hijinks and Hearsay, Sinister Stories from Minnesota's Pop Life. His work has also included a stint for the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence. The Space Pen Club is based in part on that period.
And I'm Annie Harview. In the last part of the hour, Liz Olds talks with Brian Malloy, an award-winning author and activist, about his book After Francesco. He is a recipient of the Alex Award and the Minnesota Book Award. He was an early employee of the Minnesota AIDS Project. He helped organize the state's first AIDS Walk and is an ongoing member of the community. He currently teaches creative writing in Minneapolis. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Graham Leask. I'm going to be speaking tonight with Martin Keller, who is the author of The Space Pen Club, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, UFO Disclosure, Consciousness and Other Mind Zoomers. Welcome to Right on Radio, Martin Keller.
Thanks for having me in, Ian.
In fact, we're having you back. So last time you were on here some years ago with your other book, wasn't it, with the Hijinks and Heresy. Yeah, you were on here.
Hearsay. Oh, there's a fair amount of heresy in there.
I think maybe you should change the title because everybody's saying
heresy. Hairspray, maybe.
Yeah, and my eyes are going. So it's good to have you here with this book, and it's very timely given what's going to be happening with the government shortly. But we'll get to that in a moment. Tell us a little bit about why you wrote this.
Well, I had several reasons for writing. One, I'm a long-suffering student of this issue, going back to high school when I had a sighting with college, with high school friends. Two sightings, actually. One was a little more dramatic than the other. And fast forward to the early 90s, I ended up going on a kind of a great adventure with Dr. Stephen Greer, the founder of the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, as his pro bono publicist. And we saw quite a few UFOs in our endeavors. The whole thing with Greer's organization, CSETI, is human-initiated contact, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind. So that's, and I had quite a few experiences prior to meeting Dr. Greer, 6 months prior, in my home. Inexplicable paranormal phenomena.
So that's what got you interested in this.
So
inexplicable,
I thought,
which we'll get into, inexplicable behavior in your own home.
Right.
Which suggests that in some way you are targeted. Yes?
I think that's a good way to put it. It's a mystery that I'm still trying to resolve, and I think writing the book in some ways resolved it, but at another level it completely enhanced the fact that it's still a mystery.
Okay, that sounds good. There's obviously loads of UFO books, I guess UAPs as they're now calling them, and you're jumping into a very, very large pool with this. How are we going to make that number one in that pool?
Well, I think what makes my book different is I don't know how much you've personally read about this or your listening audience has read on topic, but most UFO books are very dry. Yeah. They don't have a point of view. A lot of them are just based on individual cases, or in the case of Whitley Strieber, who wrote Communion, it's basically a confessional.
Yeah, I read that.
There's no sense of humor, and oftentimes there's never really any voice. And this book actually goes into what Steve Greer famously calls the UFO ghetto. Yeah. And, you know, I had a lot of encounters with other researchers, debunkers, people in the media, obviously, government officials, and these people from the Avery, which was an ad hoc collection of men from aerospace, intel agencies, think tanks, kind of a loose organization, but they were all interested in the topic and including psi and paranormal subject matter. So,
did you ever?
And they all had bird names, and they were the you know, like Partridge.
That's why I call
Chicken
it the
Little. And they were the alleged bad guys going into this.
And you call, that's why you call it the aviary.
I like that. I don't know who came up with it, but it's part of the lore and legend of the UFO subculture.
And Whitney Strieber, did you ever meet him and talk to him?
I met Whitley once or twice. Yeah. I can't say that we're close personals, but I've read his work. He's one of the better thinkers, not just in the UFO world, but in the geopolitical stage at large. He writes a terrific blog on his Unknown Country site that I read pretty regularly, and yeah. I love to listen to how his mind works.
He was on the show yonks ago, with War Day, I think it was. It was nothing to do with this, but it was a very good writer. And I saw that film, read the book and saw the film. Did you see the film of Communion?
Communion, yeah. I always thought a better title would be Confession, because it's pretty much him.
So what do you think about films that try to depict something that's hardly ever seen?
Well, there's some very bad ones, and there's some very great B movies that are fun just to watch for their own value. Recently, though, in the last three or four years, there's been some really excellent work done. James Fox's The Phenomena, which is just, I think it had a March debut on Netflix. Dr. Greer's three crowdfunded documentaries that have come out since 2017 are also really well done. Mm. And I think pose more questions than there are answers right now.
Netflix, if our listeners can pick them up.
Yeah, I think you can pick them up on Netflix and Prime. And I think Greer's last film, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, you can even watch that free if you find the right link for it.
Okay, good. So all this is happening. Your book has just been published a week or so ago and is selling quite well already. It's coming out right when the government allegedly is going to say something about all of this phenomena. It's probably you're going to have hold the microphone here for a while to explain all this. But tell us how that's going to affect things. What do you think they might say? What do you think they might not say?
Well, obviously, I've been following this very closely. I listened to a part of an interview with Lou Elizondo today on a national radio show that somebody posted on their Facebook site, and he said he didn't want to give away a lot of information. Lou is one of the guys who used to work inside on the UAP task force and then left it to help disclose the fact that these objects have been buzzing around our military, et cetera, and was quoted extensively in the New York Times stories that first broke in 2017 and continue to appear in the Times, which previously, you know, they never touched this with a serious attitude. But I think the expectations in the UFO community are low. On the other hand, I think there may be some genuine surprises. But I did also read that there's a classified section, and I'm betting real money that that's going to be leaked. I hope it is. Mm. The bulk of the article of the report has already been leaked to the Times, and they're saying stuff like, well, it doesn't say aliens, but it doesn't rule it out either. It's like No one can articulate what this is, which I find hard to believe because our intel agencies and select departments within military have been looking at this for over 70 years. Mm. If they don't know what it is, they should all be fired.
I had a my ex-wife's, I suppose it was her uncle, who was high up in the military. I can't tell you his name or what rank he was or anything, but he was getting ready to retire. We went to his retirement party out east, and he spoke to me. He and I spoke about this issue quite a bit, and he said, I don't mind telling you now that I'm retiring when some of this comes out, and a lot of people are going to be very, very shocked, including you, he said to me, because I'm a bit of a skeptic, as you know. But I found that very, very telling and a little chilling that he said that.
I think it's more surprising, at least in my worldview, that there wouldn't be other civilizations in deep space. I mean, the universe is pretty vast. The multiverse is even vaster.
Yeah.
You know, that which raises the next question: well, can they get here from where they are?
That's one of the things I was going to ask you is that when you look up into the sky and, you know, you're just as an ordinary human being, and it's quite intimidating in some ways, quite frightening when you realise how small you are compared to what is out there. And when you look at the nearest possible planet, which is would take us 1,000 years to get to.
Well, that assumes we're using what we know, that
sure,
we have,
sure,
the technology we have currently. But
then some of my physicist friends look at me and say, oh, I'm sorry, but I don't think we can go any faster. I hope they're wrong, because I really want this to be real.
They can go faster. They can go at subluminal speeds, faster than the speed of light. You know, I spent 5 or 6 years around Dr. Greer, and I admired his work. I still admire his work, and he has quite a few theories on how that works, and a lot of it is related to mind, consciousness, and that these objects have figured out a way to bend the space-time continuum, mm-hmm, with either technologically assisted consciousness or consciousness-assisted technology. And that makes sense to me. If we have a civilization that's a million or even a billion years older than ours, they may have figured out all the tricks to physics that we don't understand about deep space or even the space around Earth.
Well, given that according to the Big Bang Theory anyway, the universe is over 13 billion years old, I mean, there could have been thousands of such civilizations that have come and gone.
Well, there was a RAND report that was never peer-reviewed, but it was finally released after so much pressure from the UFO world in 1997. It was written back in 67, and it said basically all the things that the new telescope technology, the Hubble and the Kepler and some of those other high-tech satellites that we have in orbit are finding, you know, that there are probably millions of civilizations like ours around stars. And this was, you know, a speculative report written 40, 50 years ago. And now our science is catching up with that assessment. You know, and the RAND Corporation is on the conservative side of the world. It's not given over to subjects like this too often, which is maybe why it was never peer-reviewed, but it's very well written, very well reasoned. It also points out something that many subsequent books since then have come out and said, that a lot of these things have been buzzing around our atomic missile silos. And that's one of the things that's starting to appear in the news more and more. It's like, what are they doing?
I remember as a kid, I went mad about Eric von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods and all that kind of stuff, and even went to some of the places to take a look at what was there. And it was largely debunked, I think, to some extent, but it depends who you talk to, whether you think it was debunked or not. But you know, the whole, he introduces, the first one to introduce ley lines and all those kinds of...
Ancient Astronauts, yes, baby. I don't think I ever actually read that book. I mean, I read a lot about it. One of the quotes in my book, and there's quite a few source quotes in this work, is a quote from J.B.S. Haldane, a British geneticist and evolutionary biologist, who in 1927, and he's going to use the word queer here because obviously had different meaning 100 years ago, but he says the universe is not only queerer than we can suppose, but it's queerer than we can suppose. I mean, I think that that says it all right there. That's the end of the interview. That's, you don't even have to read the book. I mean, that's it. That's that's the world we live in, really.
Sure, that's right. Somebody there scrats, making strange noises on the chair. Who knows, it might be an alien. So I'm intrigued to find out some details about what actually happened to you.
Well, quite a few things, actually.
Well, again, let's get one that's appropriate for talking about over the air, and tell us it. Tell us the story. What happened?
Well, there were a lot of synchronistic things that were happening in my world in 1992. Prior 6 months prior to even meeting Steve Greer and the CSETI organization, and a lot of it was things happening in our house, lights coming on at, after we'd turned them all out for the night. Balls of little red orbs. It's probably the most dramatic, probably 6 or 7 months down the road from when some of the strangeness started at home. Mm-hmm. And that was the most disturbing. And I'm still trying to figure out really what perpetuated it, how and why in my bedroom, 4 in the morning, and it had a nasty mental and energetic effect on me for 3 days after. Mm-hmm. And I go into quite a bit of detail about it. I did a lot of reading about hypnagogic experiences, kind of a new intersection of wakeful consciousness and sleep. That didn't seem to fit the bill, and eventually Dr. Richard Haynes from NASA Ames, pretty well-respected NASA scientist, hypnotized me, and we looked at what they might be, and there was a good deal of avoidance and hesitation on my part. So
how does that connect with the UFOs?
Well, that's one of the questions explored in the book. How does all this stuff come together? Mm-hmm. And it was the paranormal stuff in our house related to the so-called ET or alien issue? Did I have a close encounter of the fourth kind, like an onboard experience with whoever the visitors are? Or, as several books have suggested, this is maybe a manufactured event by our guys, the bad guys that run around in the black ops world. I mean, this goes in pretty deep. It starts to sound conspiratorial, but that's one of the narratives in the book, is what was this? Was this a real paranormal event, or was it a faked one? To throw me off my game, or to maybe...
Because at this point you were investigating and people knew you were doing that.
Well, I was starting to,
So that sounds very much like the whole concept of the targeted individual that is out there. It's quite a large theory that is going on. What about, like, in my family, lots of stories circulating, and kind of Celtic background, a good part of it. Things like the Banshee. You know, the white spirit, the ghosts that appear. If you look at some of the ghost stories in my family, and if I'm to put your filter on them, they could be aliens.
Well, right? They could be, and that's part of the problem with this whole topic. I mean, there's no solid definition of terms. You know, I was a award-winning high school debate champ and extemporaneous speaker and all that. And one of the first things in debate that you do when you start a debate with your competition is define your terms.
Yeah.
Now, what's an ET? Is it a three-dimensional extraterrestrial biological entity as science looks at it today? Are orbs ETs? I don't know. I'm skeptical about that. There's tons of literature on the internet about orbs.
In the ghost world, orbs are really a big thing, aren't they? And they're in a lot of houses. And sometimes they show up in photographs and not, you don't necessarily see them with the naked eye, but they're in a photograph. And you
right.
think, what is that? And you dig down and the photograph's real. It really does have something strange in it. So tell us a little bit about actual... What do you know about actual ETs, you know, creatures, you know, with intelligence that are visiting people?
Well, I can't say I've ever met one face-to-face and had a conversation, but I've read a fair amount of the literature that seems trustworthy, and, you know, I would describe those CE4 events versus an abduction event as learning events for people. Dan Sheehan recently, do you remember Dan Sheehan, the famous public interest, public policy lawyer, worked on the Watergate, Karen Silkwood, Iran-Contra. Well, it turns out Danny Sheehan is also a lifelong UFO guy who I met at a UFO conference, and I actually recruited him to join Dr. Greer's disclosure process, and he's still involved. I mean, I washed out of CSETI in the late 90s.
You've got some very interesting people, including Dan Aykroyd. We've got about a minute left. Tell us about
Dan Aykroyd. Dan Aykroyd is another, like Sheehan, another lifelong UFO seeker, for lack of a better word. And I sent him a query back in November to see if he'd write an endorsement for the book. And come March, I got one. Sure, it's a very generous.
A very good one, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, Sheehan said recently on a podcast, you know, why is all this stuff happening now? That's the biggest question this report needs to ask. It needs to address, and I'm willing to bet we're not going to get that type of basic who, what, where, why information.
Well, that's very interesting. We'll look forward to it with bated breath. This is Ian Graham-Leeskare. I've been speaking with Martin Keller about the Space Pen Club. Congratulations on writing this.
Thank you, sir.
And thanks for being on Radio again.
Pleasure. Let's do it again.
We'll do it again. And now this.
Yeah, right now.
Brian, can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Where's fantastic.
Brian Malloy, author of After Francesco. And why don't we start with you telling us a little bit about the book and then the reading that you have prepared.
Absolutely. So the book is called After Francesco, and it takes place in 1988 in Alphabet City in New York, as well as here in Minneapolis. And the main character, Kevin, is struggling to find his way after his partner Francesco died of AIDS 2 years prior to the opening of the book. So he's struggling. This happens in the first act, so no spoilers here, but he does drink himself into the emergency room, not once, but twice. And then his friends decide, you know what, you need to make some changes in your life. So they ship him home to Minneapolis, where he's originally from. And he starts volunteering with the Minnesota AIDS Project. And he meets someone there named Dave, who is also what they call an AIDS widower. Of course, marriage equality wasn't true back then, but they still use the term widower. And Dave and Kevin have tried to rediscover their sexuality and had a complete failure in doing so. So now they're just friends because they're still staying faithful to their deceased partners. Mm. So they gave it a try and it just did not work out. And we are going to join Kevin and Dave and other men whose partners have died of AIDS or whose partners are in the final stages of AIDS at a support group meeting. And this support group meeting takes place at Abbott Northwestern Hospital. And this is about the third or fourth meeting that Kevin has been at now. So it's from chapter 6 from June 1988. And the chapter is called The Drought Continues. We haven't had any rain, and we're not going to get any anytime soon. Since I'm back in Minneapolis, the weather is the thing to talk about, like crime was in New York. Anyway, it's how we're starting off tonight's support group meeting. Before we fall apart in little heaps of despair, we talk about the weather. Men are dressed in shorts and tees and muscle shirts, muscled or not, mostly not. And Dave sits next to me. You think we'd avoid each other, but strange as it seems, I actually feel closer to him after our failed attempt to rediscover our homosexuality. It's like we're failures together and we don't care. I'm wearing cutoff jeans because it's hot and I still like it when men look. There's bright colors on the preppies, green and peach, and the kid with dyed blonde hair and Aaron, with his dyed black hair, wear tight jeans with ripped out knees and white muscle shirts that show off their pale, skinny arms. Dave is Dave in his sandals and hiking shorts with a blue short sleeve shirt. Butch Bobby Joe, our facilitator, who reminds me of the second Bobby Joe from Petticoat Junction, starts us off with the usual ground rules, confidentiality, and an affirmation. Next, we go around to do check-ins. She invites Dave to start. Dave says, it's been a good couple of weeks. My garden's a disaster this year, so that's disappointing. Work life is fine, nothing too urgent coming down the pike. I giggle. Dave works for Cargill in a department literally called Meat Solutions. Butch Bobby Joe asks, any anniversaries this month? She means things like the anniversary of the first time you met your partner, moving in together, first vacation together, things like that. Dave says, as far as June goes, we really didn't do much. Gary didn't care for gardening, and our trips to the Boundary Waters waited until after the worst of the black flies and the mosquitoes. So, no, nothing significant I could think of. We loved the summer equinox. Next up is Jeff, the sexual harasser, who's enjoying the exposed skin of his fellow bereaved. As he talks about his partner, who would have been 37 this month, I notice the unmistakable violet, reddish, purplish lesions that have formed on an eyebrow and at his hairline. I don't think they were there last time. When we get to me, I just talk about gay pride in New York and how romantic it was to walk hand in hand up Fifth Avenue. It was the only time I felt safe holding Francesco's hand in public. Francesco always wanted to hold hands when we were out in the street, but I could never bring myself to do it. The other memory I share is how we flipped the bird at St. Patrick's Cathedral, just in case Cardinal O'Connor was inside. Which Bobby Joe says, there's some anger in those memories. I say, oh, sorry. She says, absolutely nothing to apologize for. There's a lot to be angry about. Next up is Aaron with the dyed black hair, and I notice it's growing out, exposing brown roots. He's missed a couple of meetings. His partner died after they took him off the respirator. He didn't call any of us. His partner was 25. Aaron starts, stops. Starts, stops. This month would have been their fourth anniversary. His brother told him it's not like Aaron and his partner were actually married or even together all that long. His parents didn't come to the funeral. Butch Bobby Joe tells him, I'm very sorry your brother said those things to you. I'm sorry you had to hear that. Your relationship is something to honor. Aaron tries to talk, and fails. Butch Bobby Joe says, Aaron, is there any more that you need to say right now? Aaron's twisted up like a pipe cleaner. Yes. If I can be honest here, on some level, I wanted him to die. I couldn't stand it anymore. He was so sick and in so much pain, and he lost his mind. I feel so bad about what happened, but I wanted it to happen, you know? I couldn't take it anymore. He fought it. Oh my God, how he fought it. He fought so hard, right up until the last breath, and that's not what I wanted. I wanted him, I don't know. I wanted him at peace. He wasn't at peace. He was terrified. Watching him struggle with those last breaths, Aaron stops talking. He looks like he's convulsing, but not a sound comes out of him. Butch Bobby Joe says, would it help, Aaron, if we made you a cradle of support? Aaron nods, wipes away his tears. The group's veterans stand in a circle, so Dave and I do too. Butch Bobby Joe says to Dave and me, the newest additions to the group, sometimes there are no words, or there are, but we're sick and tired of hearing them over and over again. So instead of words, we hold him physically in our arms, which manifest our love and support. She takes Aaron's hand and he stands next to her. Jeff tells Dave and me to join the veterans, and we form two lines facing each other. Next, we lean down and grip each other's wrists tightly as Aaron lies back in our arms. We hold him up. Butch Bobby Joe softly sings, you are my sunshine, my only sunshine. And the jaded New Yorker in me almost laughs out loud. But then the veterans join her, and I leave my ironic, cynical self behind. Aaron closes his eyes and silently weeps as we rock him back and forth, slowly, gently, held up in our arms. He's safe to cry here, to scream here, to lose his mind here, because we have him, these fags in this dike, and we won't let him fall.
Thank you. A very powerful reading from a very powerful book, After Francesco. Say, I want to start with a question that you pose in your note to the reader after the book. The first question that you pose, why revisit the trauma of the first years of the AIDS in gay America?
Well, I wanted to do it for several reasons. One is that this month, June 5th to be specific, is the 40th anniversary of the first reported cases of AIDS in the United States. And at that time, it wasn't even called AIDS. There was no name for it yet. And the report in the Center for Disease Control's weekly surveillance noted that young, otherwise healthy gay men had contracted a rare form of pneumonia, and several had died by the time the report had been issued. And that was 1981, and since then, you know, we both know the history of the disease and how many gay men died of it. About 1 in 15 gay American men were diagnosed with the disease by 1995. 1 in 15 had died of the disease by 1995, and about 1 in 9 had been diagnosed with AIDS. So it was devastating to an entire generation of gay and bisexual men. And I fear that as those of us who witness it got older, that there wouldn't be much in terms of the history written down. Fortunately, there are some good nonfiction books about the era, but I wanted to write a novel that really captured one man's experience with the disease. The other thing that I'm concerned about is that I think it was 2016 when Hillary Clinton said, you know, how the Reagans were leaders on AIDS and mm-hmm. started the national conversation about the disease. And the backlash was pretty immediate. But if there hadn't been people like us to remember and say what really happened, I think that she would never have apologized for it because she honestly believed it was true. And as we know, that was far from the truth. I'll just add one more thing about this for those listeners who are much younger than myself, that you have to imagine this disease, AIDS, as what it was. It was a fatal disease. And to put it in today's context, you have to imagine Donald Trump saying nothing about COVID during his last year in office, and Joe Biden never saying one thing about COVID during all 4 years of his first term. That's what it was like. Ronald Reagan didn't mention AIDS until 5 years in, and over 30,000 people had died of the disease. So that's why I wrote the book.
To speak about a current event and connected to history, as you know, I'm sure there's a football player, Carl Nassib, from the NFL, who has just come out. And what he said, I think, is very important. He said, he felt like he had been standing on the shoulders of those who had come before. He talked about the heroines and heroes of the AIDS epidemic, and before that and after that as well. How do you think, after Francesco takes a look at this narrative of change and heroes and heroines and standing on the shoulders of the people who came before?
Well, you know, before AIDS activism and ACT UP, of course, there was Stonewall. And even before that, there was the Black Cat Tavern in Los Angeles. And before that, there was Mattachine. And before that, you know, there's activism in pre-Nazi Germany that was shut down by the fascists once they took power. So we are standing on the shoulders of the ones who came before us, and often we don't even know that they had existed. You know, I'd heard about Stonewall. I hadn't heard about the protests from the Black Cat Cafe that happened, Tavern, which happened even earlier. I wasn't that familiar with the Mattachine Society or the Daughters of Bilitis. And, you know, I only discovered one magazine and other things when I was looking at the archives at UCLA. So we're standing on some shoulders, some we know about, some we still don't know about. They're lost to history. And I will say this about the activism of the 80s and 90s, is that it really did change systems, particularly at the FDA and the National Institutes of Health, in terms of involving patients in their own care, in terms of speeding up protocols, cutting through red tape, and really having people afflicted by these diseases having a seat at the table when these decisions were made. And we also worked hard and were able to leverage increased funding for AIDS in spite of people like Jesse Helms. And I would say we took our confrontations to the places that needed to be confronted, like the CDC, like the White House, like the Supreme Court, like putting a giant condom on Jesse Helms' house. I mean, we took it to the people, St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. We took it to where we needed to take it, to challenge the people who are standing in the way of research and compassion.
And how, I am of an age that I lived through the epidemic and saw my brothers die. And I worry sometimes that young people are not knowing that they're standing on the shoulders of the people who came before. And are, in fact, the history of AIDS is going away, that people aren't remembering it or thinking about it. And I'm wondering what we can do to keep this memory alive that's so important to the GLBTQ plus community.
Well, I think part of it is commemorating anniversaries, like the 40th anniversary of the first CDC report. I think, you know, in 1987, the NAMES Project AIDS quilt was displayed for the first time on the Mall in Washington, D.C. So there's anniversaries that we can commemorate just as we commemorate Stonewall each year. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think with AIDS, given that the first CDC report was on June, that part of pride now can be to honor those people who fought and died in a literal struggle, life and death struggle, against not just a disease, but ignorance. And if you look at Burroughs Wellcome, in their instance, insatiable greed. And the other thing we need to remember is that the violence against gay men, in particular in New York at that time, was pretty horrific, and the murders weren't investigated, the gay bashing murders. So I don't want to be, you know, the cranky old man who says in my day at the same time. And I recognize that today's generation has their own very significant challenges that they're facing. And I think if they look back and see this as a source of strength as opposed to a traumatic experience, that we came out of this strong and we changed the public's mind about our community based on our response to AIDS.
We're speaking with Brian Malloy, author of After Francesco. And let's talk a little bit about the story now that we've gone through some of the history. Kevin is a very complex character. His relationships are very complex. He's gay man, straight couple, his aunt, even his sister, which we'll maybe talk about later. Could you talk about those relationships? Let's start, of course, with his relationship with Frankie.
Well, he met Francesco in 1981. Before the first CDC report, and he was smitten. Kevin was smitten. He had a little fan crush on an actor, and he went to a bar on Christopher Street, and there was Francesco, who looked amazingly like this actor. So, of course, the attraction at first was very much physical, and after that, it became something deeper. When he got to know Francesco better, and Francesco's very relaxed nature and his complete self-acceptance of himself as a gay man, which was something Kevin was still struggling with. Francesco had completely accepted himself and didn't have these self-doubts or self-hate that Kevin had experienced. Francesco had pretty much purged himself of that. And that was part of what really attracted Kevin to Francesco, was his ease with himself. Kevin never really felt at ease growing up or with his own sexuality. So that was part of the attraction with Francesco. And then, you know, he has friends old and new in the book. He has two friends that he knew from high school. One was his sort of stoner friend, best buddy, They're kind of the Beavis and Butthead of their high school. But this guy is straight, and straight as they come, and stands by Kevin. Because I wanted to include a character that paid tribute to a lot of the straight men my age who stood by us. We tend to think of straight men as, particularly white straight men, as the enemy. And they're really, you know, some of my best friends and strongest allies were straight white men. So part of that was to honor them. And then there was another character named Lori, who was a bit of a book nerd in high school. And she wasn't really Kevin's friend. They find themselves related by marriage, which horrifies Kevin. But then she becomes a very good friend to him. Once she moves to New York, her nickname becomes Jane Fonda. She discovers politics. She becomes an activist. She's a little bit of a know-it-all throughout the book. But she's always there to support Kevin. And I suppose the last character that readers are curious about is his Aunt Nora, who is his aunt who immigrated from Ireland and is very Catholic, strongly Catholic, but is always there for her nephew and always a source of support and tough love. She tells him things he doesn't want to hear about how he's wallowing in self-pity, how he needs to stop drinking, how he needs to get involved in the world again. She's the one who makes him go to the support group. There's a lot of wonderful people in Kevin's life that help him on this journey.
You know, we only have 1 minute left. I can't believe it. I have so many more questions, but let's talk a little bit about Pride Month. It is Pride Month, and it's odd to me. I feel like it's getting a little commercialized with advertisements with GLBT people, and the twins are having a Pride Month celebration. And I look at it two ways. I see it, one is possibly getting over-commercialized, but also the other side is that we are becoming a part of a larger community, which is good. So I'm wondering which way you think about that, or both.
You know, it's this month, everything has a rainbow slapped on it.
Right.
Pet food to life insurance.
Yeah.
It wasn't always that way. You know, back in the day, marching in gay pride, you didn't know what was going to happen. And I'd gotten in some shouting matches back in the earlier pride marches with people who were heckling us or threatening us. So, you know, I don't know about you, but I feel like I've lived several lifetimes in one lifetime, because mm-hmm. when I was born, homosexuality was illegal and we could be involuntarily institutionalized and criminalized. And today we have marriage equality. Last year, or maybe 2 years ago now, we have federal civil rights protection from a conservative Supreme Court, which I never would have imagined. So part of it is my sense of disbelief. And part of it is asking myself, what are you really nostalgic for when you look back at all that? You know, at the time, you didn't know if you were going to make it through it or not. So when you look back, it seems like you were young and passionate and committed. But, you know, if you really look back at that time, you didn't know
right.
if we would be here today. So I try not to let nostalgia cloud my thinking too much.
We've been speaking with Brian Malloy, author of After Francesco, a wonderful book. I highly recommend it, especially during Pride Month here and the 40th anniversary of the first cases being discovered. So, Brian, thank you so much. I wish we had more time, but we don't. So I'll have to
well,
let you go.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure,
I really
thank
appreciate
you. Okay, bye-bye.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie Harview. I'd like to thank our guests from tonight, Martin Keller and Brian Malloy, plus our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at kfai.org/program/Right on Radio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our podcast. You can find it on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcast, and anywhere podcasts can be found. Now, stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.